Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, how schools turn children into industrial robots by design, why the power elite likes popular violence and hatred, and more. It's all in part two of the film Human Resources. I hope you'll stay tuned. In film, the documentary has been having a rebirth in recent decades. Credit for this is often given to filmmaker Michael Moore, producer of Roger and Me, Fahrenheit 9/11, and other film hits. I'm grateful to Moore for reviving the genre, but actually I'm not a big fan of his films. I think he plays fast and loose with the facts. His politics are too close to the middle of the road. He thinks flashy stunts prove a point. And he just doesn't come across as very smart. At least to my jaundiced eye. I'm not saying that Scott Noble is a better filmmaker than Moore in the technical sense. Noble is certainly less of a business success. That may be because he gives his films away, and nobody gets charged admission. But in Scott Noble's work, I see a shrewd intelligence and also a radical perspective on our social problems. Both virtues are surely needed these days, as John Dewey himself said close to a century back. Noble's film Human Resources focuses on how a powerful elite controls a society that is supposedly a democracy. They do it by systematically robbing the demos, that's the common people, robbing us of money, sure, but also robbing us of power, robbing us of control, and even robbing us of the ability to understand what is being done to us. Sovereign human beings are being reduced to mere human resources. Last week's installment focused on managing the workplace, how the principles of efficiency expert Charles Winslow Taylor and his ilk systematically reduced the power of workers to control the workplace, or even to influence the workplace. This week, the film turns to our public schools. We see how, from their very founding, schools are designed not to educate children, still less to empower them, but basically to turn them into predictable cogs in the machine that is the U.S. economic system. This segment features the right-wing educational critic John Taylor Gatto and the center-left educational critic Alfie Cohn. They may be far apart on the political spectrum, but they see pretty much eye to eye on what the schools are really up to. The focus then shifts to the sources of violence in our society, and how the elite encourage the oppressed to fight amongst ourselves. This keeps us from uniting and battling our real enemy, the elite. Let us now hear our second installment of Scott Noble's documentary film, Human Resources.
One of Frederick Taylor's descendants, John Taylor Gatto, has rebelled against his forebears' legacy. An award-winning teacher, he has also rebelled against the state of his profession.
An Albert Einstein quote, "Education is what remains after one has forgotten everything he learned in school." John Taylor Gatto.
The key is the word compulsion. The idea of drawing all young people into some universal program administered by the leader or the leaders is as old as Plato, probably older. But nowhere on earth was that able to be imposed until Northern Germany, under the military rule of the Prussians, finally imposed that in 1818, so in the first, second decade of the 19th century. That is the first time. It was announced in other places, but never was it able to be successfully administered because the idea is so crazy and so damaging inherently that people simply disobeyed the law. The experience of Prussian Germany was that it was possible to convert sovereign human beings into human resources. That's a translation of a German compound. And that by making these people incomplete, making them unable to think in contexts, but they could be converted into specialist tools for management, scientific management. Horace Mann was hired by the railroad and coal interests of New England to bring about compulsion. He had no interest in schooling. He was an ambitious young politician. He did get compulsion laws passed in 1852. Once it was in Massachusetts, it spread very, very slowly. It wasn't for 15 more years that another state followed suit. So it hardly was a gift to the populist portion of America. I smile a little bit when I say that because the mythology is that it was greeted everywhere with great enthusiasm.
Not only did parents resist compulsory schooling, they sometimes did so violently. So vehement was the opposition in Barnstable on Cape Cod that state militia were brought in to march children to school under armed guard. A primary reason why the mass of the American population resisted compulsory schooling was a widespread belief that its purpose had little to do with education and everything to do with control. Their suspicions were well-founded. An undercurrent of class warfare runs through early American education documents. The U.S. Bureau of Education Circular of Information for April 1872 explains that inculcating knowledge teaches workers to be able to perceive and calculate their grievances, thus making them more redoubtable foes in labor struggles. Such an enabling is bound to retard the growth of industry. 16 years later, in the report of the Senate Committee on Education, is equally explicit. We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes.
The first Red Scare, in my judgment, is the trigger event for the embedment of compulsion schooling in the United States. The Red Scare of 1848 is probably the reason that one American state fell under the compulsion regimen. There are literally thousands of books from the period 1880 to, say, 1920, roughly, that deal with how you scientifically engineer a factory or a church congregation or young people in school. School, which followed a general outline of converting kids into obedient tools, now took on a very, very mechanistic aspect under this surge of scientific engineering.
In 1903, the Atlantic Monthly called for adoption of scientific management in schools. Prominent education theorist William C. Bagley stressed a need for unquestioned obedience. The new system would train children for life in 20th century America, their role to fulfill the needs of commerce, industry, and government.
In a community with the best education, more shoppers, more merchandise moving, a higher average of per capita sales. In the other community, fewer shoppers. Maybe things will look up in the long run. In the first community, there's a larger magazine circulation per 1,000 population. A much smaller circulation in the second community, a decline in demand. the student of typing, shorthand, and business machines, becomes a producer upon graduation, a tax-developed community asset. He prepares for radio and electronics. His future promises a profit on the taxes invested in him. As education raises the cultural level, so it must also introduce youth to the know-how of production and stir interest in precision, efficiency, and service. With graduation, the community receives a new supply of young people who want a better life on the one hand and who have the ability to work for it on the other. Now the tax investment returns to the taxpayer.
In order to aid in the process, the Gary Plan was introduced. It had a new organizational scheme in which different subjects would be taught by different departments. Similar to the breaking down of factory jobs under Taylorism, students would be herded from classroom to classroom in order to digest a stream of standardized factual information, like Pavlov's dogs. They would do so at the ring of a bell.
Children go a-sailing.
Confusion.
Send me and don't send me one by one. Two was born.
The first lesson I saw was the terrible confusion that's in any school as people race about at bell-marked intervals. The time-honored experience of mental development is that it occurs with strong concentration, not with fragmented attention.
Class position.
You will not find the doctor's son, however ignorant he is, in the class with the marginalized kids.
Indifference.
Indifference is wonderful. This is a factory to create indifference to intellectual things, to ideas. They have to be whipped, ordered, and disciplined to do anything. Or, just as bad, they have to be offered bribes to do it.
Emotional dependency.
Sure. Probably half of the 60 million kids who attend school in the United States, removed from their own families at a very vulnerable age, become emotionally dependent on a pat on the head, a smile, avoiding an insult.
Intellectual dependency.
In spite of rhetoric to the contrary, a teacher's nightmare is invested in those kids, if any, who actually have learned how to think for themselves. The teacher's job is not only to convey bits of information that should not be challenged, but also to convey how you connect those bits of information, but not practice in doing that for yourself. You memorize someone else's connection.
What is a circle? Billy Henlow.
A circle is a closed curve in which all endpoints on the circumference are equally distanced from the center points.
Very good.
Provisional self-esteem.
Provisional self-esteem, this really ties into the grades, the test scores, the signs of approval by the teacher. You're allowed to feel good about yourself if an authority issues a signal that you can do that. On the other hand, if the authority condemns you, the only way you can feel good about yourself is to become an outlaw.
Alfie Cohn, educational theorist.
What are we trying to do? If our goal is to help kids become critical thinkers, lifelong learners who really enjoy thinking and reading and playing with numbers and ideas, if we want to help them become good learners and good people who can create and sustain a functioning democracy, then education would look very different from the way it looks right now, at least in our culture. We would have to question the use of grades. What research finds is that when kids are trying to get good grades in school, three things tend to happen. They begin to lose interest in the learning itself. Now the purpose is just to get a good grade, rather than to engage with the question or problem at hand. Second, They tend to think less deeply and retain knowledge for a shorter period of time compared to kids who don't have any grades. And third, they tend to pick the easiest possible tasks. That's not because they're being lazy, it's because they're being rational. If we tell kids we want to see a better report card, we want to see higher grades, naturally they'll pick the shortest book or the easiest project because that maximizes the chance of achieving that goal. So regardless of what your goal is, if you're interested in assessing kids and teachers and schools to see, are we doing a good job here, you would never need tests in order to see whether kids are learning and where they need help, and you would never need grades to report the results of the evaluation we place on those assessments. We would certainly do away with standardized testing, the kind of testing used in particular states or provinces where everyone takes the same test and then you compare everyone's scores. These tests tend to measure what matters least. It tends to be a good marker for family income, because what standardized tests mostly measure is the size of the houses near a school. But it's the case that some of our deepest thinking kids just don't do well on tests. And some kids who get great scores have never had an original idea in their lives.
Well, I thought you just judged by tests.
Oh, no. There are many other things besides tests that we use. Of course, we do consider a child's general ability and the way he scores on standardized tests, but that's not all.
Competition builds character. In fact, what we find is that by any reasonable notion of character in terms of psychological health or self-esteem, that competition undermines that and creates a kind of neurosis, because we come to think of ourselves as good and competent only to the extent that we have defeated other people. And so we're always playing this desperate king of the mountain game, where we're all worried about triumphing over other people and stepping on their faces and looking at them as if they're going to step on our faces. That has two effects. One is it's horrible for us in terms of psychological development, because there's a perpetual sense of disease and anxiety. But second, it very logically has a destructive effect on our relationships. We compete because we're raised that way, not because we're born that way. I mean, take, for example, the belief in survival of the fittest, which is seen as a Darwinian notion. In fact, Charles Darwin never even used the phrase survival of the fittest. That was coined by a right-wing social thinker in the 19th century named Herbert Spencer, who tried to corrupt Darwin's thinking to his own reactionary political purposes. What Darwin talked about was natural selection, which means that the individual organism that's best able to adapt to a changing environment is more likely to be around to survive and reproduce. But that doesn't specify competition as a mechanism. In fact, often the active avoidance of competition, if not the deliberate pursuit of cooperative strategies, turns out to make it more likely that organisms and entire species will survive. The research consistently shows that competition not only isn't necessary for excellence, but tends to impede excellence on most tasks. And the more challenging the task, the more ingenuity, problem-solving skill it requires, the more competition tends to disrupt that achievement. Excellence pulls in one direction, and competition pulls in another. And in fact, another kind of research study corroborates that. If you take a whole bunch of people and give them a task to do, some kind of problem to work out, and half of them are told, see if you can figure out how to do this task. And the other half are told, this is a contest with a prize to whoever wins, whoever does the best job. Study after study after study across cultures, across gender, across ages, find that the people who compete, who have to compete, end up doing an inferior job on that task. At the moment, it appears as though much of what happens in schools in North America is really for the convenience of people who have most of the power. There is, if anything, an act of discouragement of critical questioning. Corporations claim they want kids who are able to think outside the box, but only so far as they're caught within a larger box that works to the advantage of the free market, which means that the market economy, based on competition, based on economic rather than human considerations, ends up controlling the system.
Today, many people assume that antisocial and even violent behavior by young people is a completely natural phenomenon. Yet anthropological studies reveal this to be a myth. Our widespread use of the term juvenile delinquency exposes not only the failure of modern schooling, but of an important concept given expression by the behaviorists. They called it the frustration-aggression hypothesis.
A quote by James Anthony Fowder: fear is the parent of cruelty.
The frustration-aggression hypothesis was an attempt by behaviorists at Yale to combine their own science of behavior with that of the Freudians. Simply put, when people perceive that they are being prevented from achieving just rewards, their frustration is likely to turn to aggression. This study by the behaviorist Hobart Maurer showed that when rats could not achieve their expected reward, they began to take out their frustrations on each other. The scientist notes that two animals which have lost their hold on the pellet, frustration, will be seen to turn on each other, displaced aggression. Similarly, in a 1941 experiment, toys were placed behind a wire screen where children could see but not touch them. When they eventually gained access to the toys, their play became considerably more destructive. On the one hand, human beings are not rats. Armed with the necessary information, we can come to a logical conclusion about who is to blame for our frustrations in life. Rightly or wrongly, we often point the finger squarely back at ourselves. Yet in the hands of politicians and demagogues, frustration-aggression can be a potent tool in deflecting anger onto scapegoats.
They want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, throughout of which will come a conglomerated balada mongrel class of people.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate this. We hate Jews. We hate faggots. And we hate specs.
We kill the faggots. We kill the lesbians. I said, God damn it, we kill them all. Why kill the elder crackers? The old crepit crackers in South Africa. How in the hell you think they got old? They got old oppressing and killing black people.
I'm not going to discuss it. If he says murder gets murdered, if a murderer gets murdered or slain, capital punishment, that's fine with me. Line them up and we'll clean up our nation overnight. Start with the abortionists. Might as well get rid of a few of those beasts.
Michael Savage, talk show host.
I'm so sick of them! I'm so sick of the brainwashing about Islam and Muslims and the Quran! Shove it! Shove it all! I'm sick of it! Get, take the music off. These throwbacks think they're better than you underneath it all, and 90% of them are on welfare. Speak it out at the supermarket. Tell them what you think of Islam. Tell them what you think of Muslims.
Jay Severin, talk show host.
We're talking about illegal immigration. So now, in addition to venereal disease and the other leading exports of Mexico, women with mustaches and VD, now we have swine flu. And when you scoop up some of the world's lowest of primitives in poor Mexico and drop it down in the middle of the United States, poor, without skills, without language, not sure our culture, not sure our hygiene, haven't been vaccinated, look at all the things we take for granted. It's millions of leeches from a primitive country come here to leech off you.
I don't know what happened tonight, and I don't know why.
Also, the gay agenda and Harry Potter.
Pat Robertson, evangelist.
Professors, the 101 most dangerous academics in America, and that's just a short list of the 30,000-40,000 of them. They're like termites that have worked into the woodwork of our academic society, and it's just it's appalling.
Howard Zinn, historian.
Scapegoating. And the hope is that by deflecting the anger of people, which might be directed against the system itself, deflecting the anger against these other people, the system would save itself. In the South, the black people became scapegoats. and you directed the anger of white people. Poor white people in the South were the people who joined the Ku Klux Klan. These poor white people might have rebelled against the governments of the South and against the national government, but no, they were told that black people were the source of their problem.
He entered the facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, "I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more." 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
Bullets fly, leaving a local family scared to be in their own home. Tonight, investigators say hate was driving the man who pulled the trigger.
Deputies say last month, someone opened fire on the Hashems because they're Muslim.
And I need to know who hates us that much, who wants us to die.
Authorities in California are urging Jewish schools and temples to stay alert following a shooting at a synagogue in L.A.
The attack happened in the same area of Bushwick where another Hispanic immigrant was killed.
Vera left a food pantry here at his church in Lower Manhattan, carrying his groceries. He biked across the Williamsburg Bridge and into Bushwick, where police say he was allegedly struck in the head, then thrown off his bike as three black males yelled anti-Mexican slurs.
On the left-hand side of your screen, you can see the two attackers shove and punch Jack Price, the openly gay victim, now in a medically induced coma. The attack accelerates, with both suspects flailing their arms at the helpless 49-year-old.
There was utter pandemonium outside the university building as ambulances carted away the injured. Police have now confirmed 14 students dead, all women. Another dozen people were hurt, caught in a rampage that witnesses called a human hunt, with the gunman yelling, "I want women."
Here we must pause for a week. Please come back next week for part 3 of Scott Noble's film, Human Resources. Our thanks to Robin Upton for the radio adaptation. You can find more of Robin's work at his website, unwelcomeguests.net. And you can find more of New World Notes at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you will tune in again next week. Power to the people!